January 1st, and for the new year, institute the $35 fee. Other people think that they're just going to make believe that no one said anything about a fee and just keep on going where they're going. Because there was a bit of a change in the administration between the bright idea of charging us and now. You can do it through the ARRL. You could also do it very easily through the FCC. I went to the FCC ULS site. If you ever logged in before, you have an FRN number, you have a password, and if it's coming up time for you to renew, it's a very, very pain-free. You click a bunch of things that you haven't been arrested, people haven't taken your license away, and before you know it, you're out of there. And a day later, you get a computer-generated message. They would like you to include your email address. Nowadays, the FCC requires email addresses in addition to regular mailing addresses. And they sent me an email saying, yeah, you've been approved. Congratulations. So it's very painless.
Okay, very good. Thank you so much for the information. Good evening.
You're welcome, Ed. Like I said, completely painless. I know that one of the benefits that the ARRL promotes is that they'll do it for you, which is nice. I don't know. It seems kind of very simple to do directly, so I did it that way. But if you remember, and I think, you know, I hate to kind of push spending money anyway. ARRL is a decent organization, and it has a lot of fine publications. I find USC to be an enjoyable read. It's not the most technical journal I've ever seen. QEX, which is another journal, which you get for free. They won't mail it to you, but you can download it. You can read it on their website, along with another contesting publication. It's called QEX. NSJ? I don't know. There's another publication. But it's a good thing to be a member of. So one of the things that they do is they handle the renewals for you people out there. But if you don't want to do it that way, like I said, the FCC is a very simple thing to do. Once again, this is AC News. My name is Roy, and this is the Limar Technical Net. So if anyone has any other questions tonight, please hit that push to talk button. Give me your first name and your phone number.
NY2H, Lou.
Yes, Lou.
So I was just perusing through some of your latest posts, and I saw, and it's intriguing me, you have something there from Thunderfoot. debunking the 60-minute story of the UFO, the aerial phenomenon. And I was trying to bounce through the video, and I heard something about birds. Maybe you can give me a little background, what's going on there.
Yeah, I posted that last week. He's an interesting guy. He's a chemist. He's working in Czechoslovakia. He does a lot of YouTubes, and he's not a particular fan of Elon Musk, among other people. His belief, looking at investigating the images of some of the fighter jets, is that they're wrongly detecting basically large birds as UFOs. He seems to think that they're very consistent and that judging from parallax error and misunderstanding the distance that these things are is kind of distorting the perception sometimes. That's his take on it. Recently, there's been a release of a study where the military basically says they can't prove that UFOs are aliens from another planet, but they can't prove that they are aliens from another planet, which in my book means they're not aliens from another planet. But I don't know. It seems to have taken off all over the place. A lot of journalists are writing a lot of stories about this questionable subject.
Do you think it's some advanced technology that maybe we're working with?
I think some of the reports are. because a lot of times they're suspiciously close to the skunk works. So I think sometimes the sightings are experimental devices that we're playing around with that the government doesn't want us to know about. But then I also think that there are some things that are just misinterpreted. Fighters, jet pilots are great people. They have great skills. I don't know if they're particularly trained to go down algorithms of what could possibly look like a UFO that is just a bird. So I don't know whether they have that expertise. It doesn't seem to really come to mind when you think of a fighter pilot, though.
Well, what's old is new again. I remember sitting in my chair in front of the TV as a kid, and the show would begin, "It's a bird, it's a plane, it's Superman."
I love that show, especially Dr. Periwinkle. I think there were two episodes with Dr. Periwinkle, and the one that had him turning something into gold was one of my favorite episodes.
Time ago. All right. Yeah, I kind of think maybe he is. So.
The funny thing is, if you look historically at unidentified flying objects, you'll find that the first report was of a cigar-shaped object. It was only when some reporter got it wrong entirely and changed it for some reason to a saucer-shaped object that all of a sudden every future sighting was described as saucer-shaped. So it seems rather odd that a reporter's error would predict the future shape of alien spacecraft.
Well, was it Dawkins? Richard Dawkins? I'm not sure. Who described the meme? And he described it in very evolutionary terms. So you have something which takes on a life of its own, survives in its environment, and evolves. And evolves based on different pressures. So not necessarily truth, but, you know. So the meme is like the gene, in a sense, and it can mutate.
Yeah, well, he wrote the book The Selfish Gene, so he might have presented that as a comparison. But yeah, memes can be highly infectious. You know, they're kind of like earwigs, not the real earwigs that were fabled to eat through your brain, but the stalks that get stuck in your head and you just can't get rid of them. So there's a lot of ideas and concepts that, for some odd reason, they just fit a shape that works well in people's brains and it festers and it spreads all over the place. I mean, some people might suggest that religion is a infectious meme. I'll leave that to philosophers and religious people. There's a lot of ideas and agency is a very important part of apparently the human mind. We like to recognize that there's a consciousness out there that's controlling things or watching things or doing things. In the very old days, the agency was given to rocks, trees, and all kinds of inanimate objects. But as time went on, they moved into angels, then they moved into ghosts, and I think now they just shifted somewhat from ghosts to aliens. And, you know, why would they spend so much time anally probing some of these people that you've seen interviewed in the past? I mean, I think they have better ways of spending their time personally.
Well, I think here's the real story. They came down, they took the animals, and they added a little genetics and made us very smart. And the reason they did that is because a brain with a lot of neurons and everything is quite a delicacy, especially with the faba beans.
It's as good an idea as any. I have enjoyed many a science fiction that presented that topic. The entire Alien movie series kind of was premised on the fact that the engineers had landed on the Earth long before there was life and seeded it with life that eventually would evolve to creatures somewhat similar to themselves. They did that trope for Babylon 5. They've done it all over the darn place. I'm sure they did it for X-Files. So it's a very popular one. Again, it's an agency. It's a concept that things can't just happen. There's no such thing as dumb luck or random occurrence. Nothing is just happenstance. It all happens for a reason. So you then have to either pose a god to give the reason, or if you're disinclined to do that, then the next best hope is a brilliant alien race controlling us from the behind the curtain.
This is NY2H. The brain is a meaning-making machine, and what I mean to say is that if we don't have the whole story, we will fill in the blanks. It's as if we need a continuum so that whatever we don't know, we'll make it up. We'll fill in the potholes with whatever we have available. Not necessarily true, but it seems to be what's one of the tendencies of the human brain possesses.
I agree with you entirely. The human mind is very fearful of the concept of chaos. Chaos doesn't have any foreseeable rules. Human beings, even though a lot of human beings like to break the rules, they still like to have rules. And a chaotic, coincidental existence kind of frightens the heck out of all of us. And we're also designed to be excellent at pattern recognition. So we can see things that aren't necessarily obviously connected, and we can jump in and connect them. Unfortunately, we do it too often when things can't be connected. And that's why stars in the sky are supposedly named after figures that you need a heck of an imagination to connect those dots to some of the figures, Virgo and such. We'll pattern recognize it, and even if there is no pattern, we'll force a pattern on it. So that's the problem. One of the two things is we don't like chaos. We are great at pattern recognition. We don't believe in coincidence, and we seek for agency, even evil agency. You know that all the terrible things that have befallen us is due to someone, somewhere, or something that's evil, for the sake of being evil, I guess.
And again, evolution and survival have a lot to do with it. I think, the visual system is incredible, and there's so many shortcuts it has to take for efficiency. Not always. I did notice you had that color thing up there, too. I had seen that before, where all the balls are the same color, but they put lines through it of different colors, and you get a whole different effect. So again, I think all of those algorithms in our visual construct are there for survival purposes, and that's how they evolve. Again, not necessarily a true representation of what's there, but apparently it has some positive evolutionary aspect to it, which helped us survive. So, there you go. All right, back to that NY2H.
Yeah, I mean, the human mind is a fascinating thing, and one of the problems is that you have to somehow compress the signal because it would require too much information transfer. So there are ways that, lossy compression is not just a algorithm for computers, but is the way that we work as well. On an evolutionary scale, there are some things you can throw out and get away with and survive. There are others that can't. And so that's the cause of a lot of optical illusions. And illusions in general are shortcuts that sensory paths use to cut down on the required bandwidth. I had a story earlier that I found fascinating, that the question was whether or not cats have the same optical illusions that we have, because it's kind of difficult to ask a cat any questions related to that. What they found was that cats seem to have an innate desire to sit in square-shaped things on the floor. If you draw a square large enough to fit a cat, chances are very good that they'll come and sit on that square. Then they took an optical illusion where they took four circles, cut out a quarter of them, lined them up so that their negative space looked like the edges of a square, and sure enough, the cat sat right down in the middle of that, which is a good indication that the cats suffer from the same optical illusion that we do.
K2GJE.
Weimar TechNet tonight. Yeah, I saw that. And people listening, it's as if you had, four circles, but you cut out what appears to be a square, and your mind fills the square in, so I guess the cats have that same thing going for them visually. And I also understand, I think cats, if you, like, put a piece of rope or something on the floor, it kind of freaks them out. I don't know, maybe they're associated with snakes or some kind of threat. So there's a couple things going on there, too, but yeah, all very interesting. All right, let me listen out. Carry on. Maybe your friend is on EchoLink by now, and you could do the mailbag. NY2H back to that.
Okay. I mean, I think it's kind of well known. It is kind of a built into the bone type of wariness as far as snakes are concerned. Most human beings are repelled by snakes, and cats, I think, are as well. So anything that kind of looks naked to a cat might upset them. So I thank you for this interesting discussion, Lou. And K2GJE, I believe you wanted to say something.
Just one small comment. All of these UFO sightings, I believe, have been visual. Either fighter pilots or commercial pilots, but at all the airports, controllers are looking at radar 24 hours a day. We haven't gotten any reports of them seeing this on their indicators, and the radar indicators now go out quite far, as far as nautical miles. We haven't got electronic information, have we? Over.
Well, not to my knowledge yet, but I'm sure if you mention this to a group of people who are so inclined, they would start to tell you, along with their anti-gravity drive, because they wax poetic about this stuff. They'll tell you that they don't have any propulsion systems because they haven't been able to image any exhaust coming out from anywhere from these things. So, you know, again, partially because they're out of focus plane windows and lights and sometimes birds. They'll along with telling you they have field generators that generate their propulsion using anti-gravity, they'll probably tell you that they have radar absorbent material covering them.
Okay, so much for that. It has your mailbag question there come in, over.
Okay, that was a strange signal for a little while. I didn't hear you yet.
What I said was, has your mailbag questionnaire come online now? Over.
Well, unfortunately, no, he has not. There's something wonky going on with my IC-7100. Let me just turn it off and turn it on, and I'll be back in a second.
KG-211.
Down a minute. Roy is rebooting his equipment.
Okay, I don't know what's going on with it. It looks like I'm going to have to take a good look at it. Well, thankfully it's transmitting, but on the receive it seems to be picking up weird signals from someplace. I don't know. I'll try and wiggle through nevertheless. No, the gentleman isn't here yet. I'll give him a little bit more if I can, and then I'll just do his mailbag question, I guess, without him, unfortunately. But David, KG2RY, you wanted to say something?
Second, WS2N, right?
Yes, Paul?
Your audio is actually better when you came back, so I don't know if you made it a change when you did that. Your audio is probably up to, you know, 5 dBs.
Okay, that's curious. All I did was power down and power back up. According to this, I have the same mic gain as before. So I'm not quite sure what the heck's going on. Again, the problem seems not to be thankfully transmitting, it's receiving. Instead of receiving, I'm just getting some random junk rather than audio. So I'm listening on one radio and talking on another, which now I have to twirl volumes up and down, otherwise I'd listen to myself with a slight delay.
Okay, well, you sound good now.
Okay, very good. David, you want to say something?
Yes, Roy. David, hope you're all having a really great one. You were talking about consciousness, and thought about consciousness, how does a person see? And a person sees through the lens of his, you know, things that we all learn and all know what they should be in terms of UFO type things, you know. We don't get such a big education for that, so it's part of some other unknown. The known, I think, is the limitation, and I think that the magic is things that you discover, you know, in your life along the way.
Okay, I mean, it's a little bit off topic from UFOs. I mean, consciousness, you can drive yourself crazy trying to figure out what the innate reality of consciousness is. There's a lot of neurophysiology that's going on suggesting that there's kind of a major portion of the brain doing regular stuff routinely that's not getting bogged down with your real conscious observations of it doing, you know, the stuff below the, under the hood, if you will. And there's a smaller portion of your conscious mind with a latency error that's getting the signal from that bigger cognitive device and interpreting it in terms it can best deal with on its own. So you may make a decision based upon something that's not in your actual awareness, because it took place at a level before you were aware of it in the first place. But you did it nevertheless, and now your brain has to find a good excuse for why you just did that, as opposed to knowing what you didn't perceive that you're acting upon.
Well, consciousness is sort of like, how to say, forward, move from one point to another, and it's sort of like being connected to the unknown, you know? Without consciousness, it would be thinking, and all mind, you know? And the mind tries to rule everything. So, if it's possible to get out of the mind, and just maybe their bigger experiences in life. And also any...
Well, I mean, that brings you to great philosophers' discourses on is the mind part of the internal machinery? Is it some external thing that's connected? You know, and different philosophers have had different thoughts on the subject. I tend to be a deconstructionist type of guy. I think it's a part of the machinery. Because if you break the machinery doesn't work anymore. And if it was all going on someplace else, I guess the receiver for what that something else is part of the machinery. So you can rationalize that you didn't break the source, you broke the receiver. But I tend to think in the easiest answer, which is if you break your brain, breaking your consciousness, personally. I mean, there's a good reason why a good bang to your head is going to lead us all to be unconscious, because our consciousness is housed in that couple of pounds of gray matter.
That's Elroy. But, you know, can keep some product and tell about that. What they can expect from, or you can say, this is good, make up your own mind. For me, better.
Well, ultimately, everyone sort of has to make up their own mind. I mean, hopefully it's an informed decision. Facts, you know, reality is not democratically based. You can't vote on whether or not there are UFOs, and if 52% of the population vote that there are, then magically there are. But each individual person has to sort of make their own decision. I think most people try not to think about it too hard because it gives them a headache, but other people can make a good living writing an endless stream of books on the subject.
Well, you know, how to say? I think I've reached my point of satisfaction. I have enough of pretty much what I want. I have the kind of person to get a sports car or a gold or something. You know, and I guess when somebody is trying to direct me in the direction and wants to tell me how it's going to be, I say, I'm sorry, I'm just not interested today.
Okay, I mean, that's your option. As I said before, we all ultimately have to find our own truth. You can believe other people and they can tell you their truth, but you have to decide whether or not you're going to agree with them. The problem is that there's not a lot of good proof for anything. There's a whole bunch of different theories. Some are more fascinating than others. None of them ultimately have any irrevertible facts to back them. So you're kind of left to choose your own until or unless some clever person can experimentally prove one concept of consciousness rather than the sundry other theories that are available elsewhere.
But Roy, it's not about agreeing or disagreeing. As somebody trying to tell me, so I say, okay, never mind. I already have two other things like it. I don't have to get this one. It's why it is that people are very eager to make it happen for them. Say, I just don't want to buy anything. How to say, it's all good, but, you know, how do you tell them, I don't want to buy it now, and can they accept it?
In my experiences, some can and some can't. I've known some people with differing opinions to the universe for me. I once had a patient, a lovely woman. She was a nun. And we had lots of different discussions on a lot of different topics. She never proselytized. On the other hand, I had another middle-aged woman who pretty much every single time she came for a medical exam wanted to convert me endlessly in perpetuity. So it's not the underlying philosophy. It's the person holding on to the underlying philosophy. Some people need to spread the word. Others don't.
No problem, Dr. Roy. I'm going to pitch you for anything. And I hope that this respect for other people, you know, especially when it's visible, you know. No thanks, not today. I already have two things like that. One, you know, I also want to get another one.
Okay, again, it depends upon the person on the other end. They range all over the place. My patient who was a nun never tried to proselytize me. The other patients always tried to proselytize me. And I'm sure there are people in the middle as well. So you push back and they stop. It's the nature of the individual, not really so much the philosophy that they're trying to push out.
Well, you know, there are certain kinds of people that try to get you, you know, and have you to give them a donation. But I guess maybe some people approaching me trying to give something to me. And, you know, I'd rather discover it. You know, I'd rather find stuff.
Okay, that's your choice. The different people have different ways of being approached. Some people are very receptive to other people's ideas. Other people have to come to their own conclusions by themselves.
And, you know, I guess maybe the last thing I'll say is that if somebody, you know, is involved in some kind of, pitch, they're trying to convince somebody of something. I would get so involved in that conversation because I wouldn't want that conversation. And so I just don't want to go there, you know, saying people do what they want if they know what it is. And if they don't know what it is, they'll never achieve what they want. So at least 50% of the way what you want and also to know what you don't want.
Okay, if that philosophy works for you, then that's great. There are different people with different philosophers, not different philosophies. There are guys out there, especially after getting a degree in philosophy, are crammed with all kinds of variations on themes. So you pick your poison and you go with it.
Thank you very much, Dr. Roy. Have a fantastic evening. I'm very thankful for this technique.
Well, you're welcome, David. It's always fun, these Sunday night get-togethers. I learn stuff. I hope some people out there learn some stuff, and I hope it interests and or amuses people. So if that's the case, then I've done my job. I'm still waiting for good old Frank. I don't know. He hasn't shown up yet. I think we're just going to cover his question, and if I have to, I'll answer it for him in an email. The question was, he's noticed that a 3,600 milliamp battery pack will not charge a 1,800 milliamp per hour, actually, not a milliamp per hour, it's a milliamp hour, cell phone battery twice. Keeping the numbers simple, assume some of the power is dissipated in heat and those battery packs are far from 100% efficient. He asked, what do you think? So basically he's saying, you know, the battery label says it's 3,600 milliamp hours, which is a way of describing charge. It's describing coulomb. Each amp hour is about 3,600 coulombs of charge. Why can't you take a 3,600 milliamp hour battery pack and charge a 1,800 milliamp hour cell phone battery twice? Anyone with any thoughts on this particular subject? Okay. Well, basically, you got a bunch of things. You got the law of thermodynamics, which means that you don't have anything that's 100% efficient, including the exchange of energy. Some percentage of the energy, as Frank mentioned, is going to be dissipated in heat. There are other problems, though. As the voltage potential of the charging battery goes down, its ability to transfer its charge decreases. You have to think in terms of, as far as the universe is concerned, although one is a 3,600 milliamp hour capacity battery and the other is an 1,800, they're both connected to positive poles and both of theirs negative poles. The only reason why the charge is going from one battery to another is because the 3,600 milliamp hour is fully charged. The voltage potential is higher than the discharge 1,800 milliamp hour cell phone battery. And so initially there's a decent amount of current transfer and charge transfer. As the voltage drops on the 3,600 milliamp hour battery, its ability to transfer gets less and less. Also, as it's working, the heat is affecting the electrolyte of the batteries, decreasing the efficiency of the transfer as well. So you have a combination of just the inherent not 100% efficiency of energy transfer. You have the increasing internal resistance and chemical inefficiencies of a heated up discharging battery, and you have the problem of the charging battery's voltage being dropping as it transfers the charge. So putting that all together, you're going to get a lot less than that 3,600 milliamp hour in the battery. Also, you have to keep in mind what that rating really means. If you were to take a battery rated at 3,600 milliamp hours and discharge it in, say, 1 hour, it would have a lot less than 3,600 milliamps of current. It's rated that way because of testing it over a long period of time. If you slowly discharge a battery, you drain it of more charge than if you quickly discharge it. So the charge and discharge rate is also an important factor. So all those things become a factor in the lifespan of a battery. Any comments? Okay, someone's interested in discussing battery technology, I guess. Any other questions or topics tonight? Maybe I'll pull out one or two articles that I posted on my link page. But before that, if any of you people have any questions or topics you'd like to present tonight, please feel free. VUS2. Say again, only half of your call time went through.
WS2N.
Oh, okay, Paul. Yes, what would you like to say?
Okay, I thought maybe I doubled with somebody else. Anyway, I'm thinking of the batteries, and I'm wondering what percentage would get into that other battery, going from 3,600 into an 1,800 one. What is the 1,800 one going to get up to, let's say, you know, 2,800 stop? Or, you know, where's it going to stop? I mean, they would eventually have to even out. if you left them connected, it might take forever because, like you said, the time is going to change as the voltage drops. But I wonder, you know, I mean, eventually they would both equal out. I don't know where they're going to equal out at. You know, if you left it over, you know, days, you know, positive to the positive and the negative to the negative, eventually they're going to come out to be the same voltage, right?
Well, yeah, it's the voltage that ultimately is going to determine when it fails, because the only thing really pushing the direction of what's charging what is the voltage differential. The total energy, though, is not constant. Every time you have any transfer, you're going to have a degree of dissipation in waste heat. So at the end of this experiment, the total charge for both batteries, assuming that the initial 1800 milliamp hour capacity battery is totally discharged, it's going to be less than the 3600 milliamp hours that the original charging battery pack had. But yeah, it'll come to a point where there'll be a voltage equilibrium between the charging battery and the recharging battery.
Okay, now, see, I have a solar panel here, and that charges. I have it hooked up to a battery. Battery, ball, 12-volt battery, you know, like the size you would put in a lawnmower. I'm not even sure of the rating. I know it's 225 cold cranking amps, but it doesn't show how many amp hours are in it. You know, I guess I could try to figure that out on the internet. But anyway, you know, you take a voltage reading on this thing, you know, before you hook it up to a solar panel, and it's roughly 12.5 volts. You hook it up to the solar panel, which if you take the solar panel and you take a reading on that, I think it's around 15, 18 volts. Sometimes you get an 18 volt reading, just not hooked up to anything. You would think that the battery would keep trying to get up to it, you know, up to that rating, but it never does. It stays at 12.5. Is that because of the cells? You know, it's got the cells in it, and that battery's not going to go over 12.5, no matter, you know, even if it's being charged, you know, at say 16 volts. It would never get up to 16 volts, is that correct?
Yeah, it depends on the chemistry of the battery itself, the cathode and the anode, and the electrolyte, and the electronegativity differential between the two. That's what determines the voltage capacity of each cell, even when it's 100% fully charged. You can't take a lead acid battery and pump in enough energy to make it output 16 volts. It'll top out at about 13 point something volts. That's the most you're going to get. That's limited by the electronegativity of the material used for that given battery.
Okay, very good. That makes sense. Yeah, it's pretty good. You know, what I can do is I plug a big radio into it, you know, but it doesn't matter. And, you know, it's actually pretty far away from the house when I do that. No extension cords, no nothing. It's pretty good. Or I can plug a 2-meter radio into it if I wanted to as well. It's a good 12-volt power source that's not hooked up to the grid. But yeah, that's what happens. The panel is above voltage, you know, to roughly 16. And it keeps the battery charged no matter what. It's really good. All right, back to you.
Okay, very good. Yeah, battery chemistry is a fascinating subject. I think we covered it multiple different times, so going all the way back to the earliest rechargeable batteries, lead acid, in one form or another, that's still around, very popular. It has some problems, but it has a lot of things going for it that have kept it alive and well even in the 21st century. Hopefully, I don't know, Frank usually is here by now, I think, but he hasn't shown up. So I'll get the email. But anyone else with any comments, questions, answers, topics, what have you, please feel free. If that's what you talk about.
If nobody has anything else, I have one more question for you. WS2N.
Yeah, sure, Paul.
Looking at your website, it's roy.ac2gs, and I came across the one where it says the COVID crisis has pretty much done flus. Looks like two different flus, strains of flu. That's the way, you know, when you read it, that's the way it's coming out. Do you agree with that article? It, you know, sounds good to me. It sounds plausible. Everybody ran around with masks for the last year. You know, maybe it did do that. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, well, I mean, I believe the article. The article kind of leaves it up in a bit of a question. The thing is that they haven't detected a variation of both an A and B influenza virus that's very common year in and year out. The theory is either it's been driven back in such small numbers that it's undetectable by medical analysis so far. It's kind of hiding below the noise floor, or it's completely died out. There are a lot of different variations of influenza. That's the problem, and that's the reason why every year we end up having to design a series of different vaccines and group them together to attack the different variants of influenza. And this past year, supposedly, they found that H1N3 type A influenza is nowhere to be found, and a variant of type B is nowhere to be found. In the coming years, we'll discover whether or not we just had a respite this year, and they might pop up next year, just as always. So we'll have to see. The bottom line is, unfortunately, we can do a significant deal with lessening influenza if we took the extraordinary case of wearing masks and socially distance ourselves. We don't do it because we don't want to do it, and because the 0.1% mortality rate, mostly in elderly people, doesn't motivate people to do that. But we could. And in Asia, a lot of times they do things like that. When there's a major influenza outbreak, you'll see pictures of citizens wearing masks and not complaining about it. It's just the price that people decide to make. If they are willing to, we could limit to a degree the infectious diseases out there that we get each year, but it's apparently too much of a price to pay, and so we probably won't. There will probably be people out there in the future who, anytime there's an influenza or any kind of a viral outbreak, whip out their masks just because they learned to do it this year, and there'll be a whole bunch who won't. We'll see.
Okay, well, that would be good news if that's true. That article is true. I hope it doesn't catch on too much where people look at it and say, well, I'm not going to get a flu vaccine anymore. You know, why should I get that? There's nothing around. And then you're going to wind up with a big outbreak. If people don't get the flu shot. I hope that don't happen for you.
Well, no doubt some people will use it as an excuse. The problem with that is that this variant of A and B are one of 100 different variants. So just to say that you don't need to get vaccinated because there's only 98% of the possible viruses that can infect you, strikes me as not great logic on their part.
Very good. Okay. Very good. That was a good topic. Yeah, I had him there on that. You got a lot of good topics. I mean, very good. If anybody wants to see these things, you go over to roy.ac2gs.com, and he's got a whole list of things. Back to you, Roy.
Yes, indeed. The first few are usually either poor visuals with illustrations, so not really lend themselves to too much discussion on the radio, or they're space-related. I certainly don't want to step on Paul, so they're further reference material to many of the subjects that Paul will introduce in the SpaceNet report. But below that is just a list of current stories that I picked, in case we ever pull the science talk segment back into being. And there are some very interesting ones. I'll give you a vaguely humorous but sad, both sad and kind of humorous in a bad way, article. And I'll give it to you right now. Let me drop for a sec. Okay, from the desk of medical irony comes this recent case study from Germany. Doctors there say a patient of theirs ended up sick in the emergency room after being poisoned by a homeopathic remedy, a quack treatment that by definition is supposed to contain virtually no active ingredient. Thankfully, the man recovered without any lasting harm. The case report was published late last month in Clinical Toxicology. Details a 53-year-old man with no pre-existing health problems who visited the emergency room of a hospital affiliated with the Technical University of Munich. He had symptoms of confusion, anxiety, slurred speech, and ataxia, as well as muscle control and coordination. All of these symptoms had started thereafter he took a homeopathic treatment containing extracts from the belladonna plant, also called deadly nightshade. Doctors soon suspected that the man was suffering from anticholinergic syndrome, a condition caused by too much inhibition of neurotransmitters like acetylcholine. Tests of the man's blood, as well as the calcium the man took, detected the presence of atropine, which is naturally found in belladonna, and is well known to inhibit acetylcholine. Atropine has long been used medically to dilate the eyes or to stabilize a too low heart rate, but it's dangerous if too high or very low dosages can cause the symptoms above, as well as others like sensitivity to light, gastrointestinal problems, and even hallucinations. Both the plant itself and its berries are also toxic when eaten, especially by children. Anticholinergic syndrome isn't the most pleasant experience in the world to go through, but it's rarely life-threatening. And in this case, the man was simply observed and recovered on his own without needing any specific treatment, the doctors reported. But they also estimated that the level of atropine found in the homeopathic preparation were about 600 times higher than was advertised. Rare but possibly dangerous manufacturing errors should be considered when faced with symptoms occurring after ingestion of homeopathic or holistic remedies, the authors wrote. The irony here is that homeopathic medicine, which emerged in the late 18th century, is said to work by diluting the ingredients to the point where essentially none of it remains in the preparation people then take. The logic goes that these ultra-dilutions will somehow unlock their therapeutic potential and treat whatever ails you. Truly, homeopathy is little more than a glorified placebo when done right and occasionally harmful when it's done otherwise. In fact, this isn't even the first time belladonna has played a part in people being poisoned by homeopathy. In 2016, the Food Drug Administration warned the parents to stay away from homeopathic products marketed as belladonna, following reports of injuries and deaths linked to their use in infants dating as far back as 2010. Their investigation later showed that atropine and similar chemicals could be found in the product at varying dosages, and the warning eventually led to the discontinuation of popular cleaning brands connected to this poisoning. Let me drop for any questions or comments. Once again, this is ACWGM.
WHUCDL Mobile.
Hello, Andrew. How are you?
Tired. Between getting up and going to the flea market, coming home, and then changing into a different clothes and just coming back from a wedding all the same day, kind of knocks you out.
Yes, indeed, you have been a busy, busy boy.
Yes, the reason I chimed in, I wanted to mention something to you and everyone regarding the vaccine. If I can ask a question, or give you some information.
Yeah, sure, Andy, please.
Okay, well, I'm just getting on this eastbound today, by the way. I don't want to make a mistake. As you know, I got the Moderna vaccine, both of them, actually 2 months ago in April. And I had a blood test last week, and I saw my allergist. And he took a blood test for a different reason, but I told him while they're checking the blood, I wanted to see if I have the antibodies for the coronavirus. So they checked into that, and it turns out by the way, can you hear me okay? Am I making?
You were pretty good at the beginning, but whatever direction you're going in seems to be in the opposite one from the repeater, and you're breaking up more and more.
I'm actually not going towards or from, I'm parallel. I'm heading south. If you have any trouble hearing me, let me know. So the results of the test, blood work came in, just to let you know, and they rated as far as how many antibodies I have, and the highest number would be greater than 100. So, they have, like non-existent, and then that's like from 0 to 0.1. Then from 0.1 to 0.15 is, the next level and so on. Anyway, I came in at 115. The highest number that they rate is 100. So my doctor says, you are fully vaccinated and you have a very high antibody rate. Well, if I'm using that word. So I asked the doctor a question. I said, now how long does this last? That's my question. Would I need a booster shot eventually? Because if the number is so high, what happens over time? Does it eventually go down? Or does it stay the same or what? So that was my question. But right now, as of Friday, my number is pretty high.
Yes. Well, the simple answer to will you need a booster shot is no one knows. Matter of fact, there's an article in the New York Times on this very subject. The CDC is sort of fudging around and saying that you may need one later than they thought before. It may be as long as a year and a half. But again, no one really quite knows. The nature of immunology is that antibodies in your bloodstream are not the only defense. Initially, upon an infection or a vaccination, your antibody count will be the highest that it will ever be. The human body doesn't keep manufacturing antibodies unless they're stimulated to. So what will happen over time is the antibody count will drop lower and lower and lower, and at some point it will even drop below the ability to detect it in a serology test. But that doesn't mean that you're no longer immune. There is also something called memory B cells. B lymphocytes is a sort of white blood cell that manufactures antibodies. There is a colony of that type of lymphocytes in your blood, in your bone marrow and such, that are primed to produce antibodies at the drop of a hat. And as long as that population continues to exist in your body, you will have a significant immune response and you will be immune to reinfection. Very difficult to test for that. Recently, they published a report of some very nice people who allow themselves to have bone marrow aspiration, because that's the only way you can detect these lymphocytes. And they found a significant amount in people who have been vaccinated a while ago. So the good news is it's probably going to last longer, our immunity, than we first were worried about, but we don't know how long. It may be a year, it may be 2 years, it may be 5 years. What's unfortunately going to happen is they're going to look at numbers and see the infection rate. If the infection rate continues to kind of dribble down, then you may not need a booster. If, on the other hand, there are these upticks after a certain amount of months, the CDC has the drug companies testing boosters.